This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 26, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. And I see from the calendar that one of them will be coming up on August 30th. This morning, the Senate Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing postponed from last week with a very ambitious title: Oversight of the Foreign Agents Registration Act and Attempts to Influence U.S. Elections, Lessons Learned from Current and Prior Administrations. However, one of the most prominent witnesses scheduled to testify in what is presumably an attempt to unearth Russian agents in the United States will not be there. Lawyers for Paul Manafort, the well-connected businessman who was managing the president's election campaign until ties with Russia and Ukrainian businessmen forced him to step down, reportedly made a deal with the committee to testify privately at a later date. Whether the other celebrity, Donald Trump Jr., was there to testify, I'm not aware, but in any case, if and when he does do it, it'll be in private and not under oath. What is worth noting is that the last time a Senate committee held hearings dealing with the Foreign Agents Registration Act was 1963. The subject then was the activity of Israel's agents in the United States who were using the tax-exempt donations by Americans to Israel to pay for pro-Israel propaganda in the United States. Those hearings, called by Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair J.W. Fulbright, also revealed, among other things, plans by the American Zionist Council, the predecessor to AIPAC, to insert itself into every critical sector of American society to ensure support for Israel. As a result, President Kennedy ordered the Justice Department, under Brother Robert, to have the American Zionist Council register as an Israel agent under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. It was no small thing. Had it happened, it would have radically restricted the American Zionist Council activities on Capitol Hill, as well as limiting the ability of other Jewish organizations to function as brazenly as they do today on Israel's behalf. Having its lobby register as a foreign agent was something that Israel could ill afford, and so the American Zionist Council's lawyers employed one delaying tactic after another to avoid complying with the law until the murder of the president in Dallas a few months later made the issue, for all intents and purposes, moot. No president or attorney general since has made such an effort, and those undertaken by private citizens to get the American Zionist Council successor, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, to register as a foreign agent, have been rejected by the Justice Department, which more than qualifies it to be considered as another Israeli-occupied territory. That Senator Fulbright even held two sets of hearings on Israel's illegal activities in the U.S. has been largely forgotten. Experts like Noam Chomsky and Phyllis Bennis never mention it. And they would likely have become no more than a footnote in history had not Grant Smith, my guest later in today's program, written a detailed book about them, Foreign Agents, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal. Smith, director of IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, and a frequent guest on Takes on the World, is one of those who made an unsuccessful effort to see President Kennedy's wishes carried out. And we will hear about his encounter with the Justice Department as part of our interview beginning at 20 minutes past the hour. The disastrous effects produced by the failure to make AIPAC obey the law have been many, but perhaps never more on display than at this moment. Thanks to the American Civil Liberties Union, we have learned that beginning in March, 45 senators and 237 members of the House have signed on as co-sponsors of similar pieces of legislation under the title the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. If passed, this act would impose huge fines and potentially long-term prison sentences on any U.S. citizen, quote, engaged in interstate or foreign commerce, end quote, who supports a boycott of Israeli goods and services, which includes products produced in Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank, which every international body and the U.S. government have heretofore declared to be illegal. According to the ACLU, the bill would broaden two existing laws to make support of the Israel boycott subject to, quote, a minimum civil penalty of $250,000 and a maximum criminal penalty of $1 million and 20 years in prison. We take no position for or against the effort to boycott Israel or any foreign country for that matter, said the ACLU statement. However, we do assert the government cannot, consistent with the First Amendment, punish U.S. persons based solely on their expressed political beliefs. This bill, the ACLU points out, would impose civil and criminal punishment on individuals solely because of their political beliefs about Israel and its policies. The bill, says the ACLU, aims to punish people who support international boycotts that are meant to protest Israeli government policies while leaving those who agree with Israeli government policies free from the threat of sanctions for engaging in the exact same behavior, end quote. Ironically, one of the bill's 63 Democratic co-sponsors is Joseph Kennedy III, grandson of Robert Kennedy and great-nephew of John. Neither Jared Huffman nor either of our two senators were among the co-sponsors. I'll be exploring the ramifications of the Anti-Israel Boycott Act with Grant Smith later in the program. On the same overall subject, you should be aware that one of the stipulations in the Memorandum of Understanding that President Obama presented to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as part of the $38 billion gift certificate for U.S. weaponry over the next decade was that Israel would not ask for additional funding over and above its $3.8 billion annual allocation. Therefore, according to the Congressional Research Service, Israel has pledged to return to the United States Treasury any foreign military financing appropriated by Congress above agreed-upon levels. Whether Netanyahu or his agents of AIPAC asked for it, or the knee-bending U.S. Congress came up with it on its own, I can't say for sure. But the recently passed National Defense Authorization Act for 2018, National Defense for the United States, included another $705 million for Israel's national defense, as if the two countries were one, making the official aid package for Israel next year $1.5 billion. We can assume, since there has been no reporting of this in the media, that this practice will continue without Netanyahu or whoever might replace him bothering to reimburse the U.S. Treasury as Israel promised. Yesterday, I watched another grotesque performance by our even more grotesque president. The occasion was a joint press conference in front of the White House with Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. Hariri is a former playboy who entered Lebanese politics following the assassination of his politically connected father, Rafik, in 2005. What he was doing in Washington was not explained. Like his father, who had been the most prominent member of Lebanon's Sunni community, Hariri has close ties to Saudi Arabia. He is also an arch enemy of Hezbollah, the country's leading Shia party, which formed as a resistance group following Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and today, besides remaining a formidable fighting force confronting ISIS and al-Qaeda in neighboring Iraq, enjoys a decade-long alliance with the country's main Christian party, the Free Patriotic Movement, headed by former general and current as well as past president Michel Aoun. Trump's target after disparaging the Democrats in Obamacare was clearly Hezbollah, which has never attacked or threatened us. The Prime Minister and I have just concluded an extensive conversation, said Trump, about the challenges and opportunities facing Lebanon and its neighbors. Lebanon is on the front lines in the fight against ISIS, al-Qaeda, and Hezbollah. End quote. Though nothing could be further from the truth, no one in the media called Trump on it, and don't expect that this latest lie from the president's mouth will be chalked up by those in the press who are keeping count. But the Donald wasn't finished with Hezbollah. America's assistance can help ensure that the Lebanese army is the only defender Lebanon needs, said he. It's a very effective fighting horse. Not true in any military expert's opinion. Anyway, thanks. Threats to the Lebanese people come from inside as well, Trump went on. Hezbollah is a menace to the Lebanese state, the Lebanese people, and the entire region. The group continues to increase its military arsenal, which threatens to start yet another conflict with Israel, said the president. But if you follow the Israeli press as I do, scarcely a week goes by without some Israeli general or military expert warning that the next war with Hezbollah is inevitable, and since it enjoys broad support among the Lebanese public, all of Lebanon would be considered as legitimate targets by the U.S.-supplied Israeli Air Force, including the Christian sectors which back Hezbollah. Again, I wondered what was the purpose of Hariri's visit, if not to set the table for an attack on Hezbollah by U.S. Air Force or Israel, and if, looking back at who promoted and orchestrated the invasion of Iraq, wondered if Washington has not become Israel's proxy. Last Thursday, I should add, members of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee introduced legislation aimed at bolstering sanctions targeting Hezbollah. They dubbed the group a threat to Israel's security and criticized its role as an active ally of President Bashar Assad's government in Syria. Meanwhile, in southwest Syria, the agreement made between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Hamburg July 7th seems to be holding much of the consternation of the critics of both, not to mention their surprise. Last Friday and Saturday, Russian military police established checkpoints along the southwestern de-escalation zone. The checkpoints and observation points, according to a Russian official, are aimed at, quote, supporting the ceasefire regime, facilitating unhindered access of humanitarian supplies, the return of refugees and temporarily displaced persons, end quote. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu was quick to express his displeasure with the ceasefire arrangement, despite the statement by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov that they had taken Israel's needs into consideration. Quote, placing himself at odds with U.S. President Donald Trump on the issue, the Times of Israel reported last Wednesday that Netanyahu had told journalists in Paris that the agreement perpetuates Iranian plans to set up a disruptive long-term presence on Israel's northern border, something he has repeatedly vowed that the Jewish state won't tolerate. The Americans completely conceded to the Russians, a senior Israeli military official told Al Monitor, on condition of anonymity. The very names of Iran or Hezbollah do not appear in the agreement, and there is no expression of Israeli concerns at all. Our security needs are completely ignored, end quote. The question the Al Monitor correspondent Israeli Ben Caspit asks, now, what will Israel do about it? Meanwhile, in another part of Syria, Robert Fisk, writing in The Independent, reports from a desert outpost in eastern Syria that, quote, after a sweeping Syrian military advance to the edge of the besieged ISIS capital of Raqqa, the Russians, the Syrian army, and Kurds of the YPG militia, theoretically allied to the U.S., had set up a secret coordination center in the desert of eastern Syria to prevent, quote-unquote, mistakes between the Russian-backed and American-supported forces now facing each other across the Euphrates River, end quote. Meanwhile, in occupied East Jerusalem, mass protests by Palestinians over Netanyahu's decision to install metal detectors on the approach to the Al-Aqsa Mosque before Friday's prayers, following the killing of two Israeli policemen by Palestinians from Israel, and the initial refusal of the government of Jordan to allow an Israeli embassy guard who had killed an attacker as well as a bystander to leave Amman, led the Israeli prime minister to back down and remove the metal detectors. However, his decision to replace them with top-of-the-line security cameras has not lowered the political temperature of those who view the measures as the latest step by Israel to separate Palestinians from their religion, their culture, and their land. Last Friday, their march toward the mosque was greeted by Israeli police firing tear gas, rubber bullets, and reportedly live ammunition. Three Palestinians were killed and an untold number injured. Consequently, the thousands of Palestinians who come to pray at Al-Aqsa this Friday will do so as they did last week, pray on the grounds outside of the mosque, which is the third holiest site to Muslims after the Saudi cities of Mecca and Medina. The protests come just days after Israel announced the building of a new settlement complex for Jews only that will permanently cut off East Jerusalem from Ramallah, headquarters of the Palestinian Authority. Meanwhile, for the Palestinians of Gaza, the hardships caused by the cutoff of the electricity by Israel at the request of Netanyahu's longtime collaborator, Mahmoud Abbas, has disappeared from the news, but the crisis there continues. A number of Israeli news outlets reported on April 27th that the Palestinian Authority had asked the Israeli coordinator of government activities in the territories to stop funding electricity for the Gaza Strip. Quote, there is a near consensus in the Gaza Strip that the enclave is experiencing the beginning of an era marked by unprecedented punitive measures imposed by the Fatah-backed Palestinian Authority, writes Professor Haider Aid from Gaza on the Al-Shabaka Palestine Policy Network website. This period began in March when Hamas formed an administrative committee to govern Gaza. Threatened by the move, the Palestinian Authority retaliated by suspending or reducing Gaza-based government employees' salaries, withholding allocations of power, medicine, and health care, shelving freed prisoners' pensions, and denying Gaza patients referrals for treatment in the West Bank and Israeli hospitals. Last week, said Haider Aid, the PA forced more than 6,000 Gaza civil servants, most of whom were working in the education and health sectors, into early retirement. These decisions, he writes, were made in the name of the Palestinian people or the Palestinian National Project, but without input from anyone outside the Palestinian Authority, which is justifying the measures as a way to, quote, push Hamas toward reconciliation, end quote, and arguing that the national project is more important than citizens' needs, end quote. In response, Haider Aid notes Hamas turned to Egypt and its arch-rival Mohammed Dahlan, though not before attempting to lobby the U.S. administration for a role in the peace process by adopting the two-state solution through changes to its charter. The U.S. snub made it possible for Hamas to ally with a regime that has waged a violent campaign against its mother movement, the Muslim Brotherhood. Yet the Hamas-Egypt partnership is not altogether surprising, Aid points out, as it comes amid Hamas's freeze on resistance for the sake of maintaining authority, end quote. Well, working with Dahlan is another matter. I happen to recall his reputation from a previous generation when his father was security chief in Gaza in the 90s. His ties to the CIA under George Tenet and to Israel's Shin Bet were widely known. That Hamas or any group of Palestinians would have anything to do with Dahlan can be understood only as an act of utter desperation. Gazans fear worse conditions, and rightly so, we read on the Al-Shabaka website. The Strip's likely loss of Qatar as a funder and ally, as well as the all-but-guaranteed continuation of collective punishment measures inflicted on Gaza by the Palestinian Authority, signal even more miserable living conditions. This may be hard to imagine after 10 years of brutal Israeli blockade, interspersed with assaults that have left thousands of civilians killed or wounded and infrastructure devastated, but the recent electricity crisis has shown how conditions can go from worse to even worse, said the Palestinian website. As we went to publication, writes the editor of Al-Shabaka, Gaza was totally without power. That was on July 13th. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.